Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 671, titled Update on the Meltdown, Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Financial Crisis. This program is being recorded on April 26th of the year 2009. I so often start broadcasts by referencing listeners to the massive website. It's a new Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. It's got a tremendous amount of information on it. Those of you who are only listening to the broadcasts at this point are missing by far and away the greater part of the For the Record experience, to coin a phrase. This broadcast will exemplify why listeners should use the website. In particular, I'm going to be referencing one of the books that I have for download, one of the old anti-fascist books that I have for download for free on the website. I'd like to encourage people who listen to this program and take this seriously to download basically everything you can, ideally the entire website, all of the print files, all of the audio files, put them on a series of flash drives and or your hard drive, and save them for when civilization is trying to crawl up out of the darkness again, and they need a little bit of a perspective on what happened, what brought about the new dark ages, because I am, as veteran listeners would know, I'm not relatively pessimistic, I'm very pessimistic, but among the books that we're going to be referencing in this broadcast is Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens, a book that preceded his book The New Germany and the Old Nazis in 1961. Germany Plots with the Kremlin is from 1953. We're also going to be accessing some other information from that book, and we're also going to be accessing some information from the book The Thousand Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, from 1943. In order to understand history, we really have to understand history. And what we're going to be looking at in this broadcast and certainly in future broadcasts is the role of, on the one hand, and relatively superficially, Germany, but below that, the Underground Reich, and in particular, the economic network put together by Martin Bormann, utilizing Germany's cartel connections during and after World War II. The cartel connections were put in place at the beginning, in the immediate aftermath of World War I, utilizing those cartel connections in the coming Cold War and Germany's effective economic looting of Europe during the occupation, were the foundations for the Bormann Capital Network. Now, use the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's available for download for free on the website. Don't try to read these books, by the way, on your computer monitor. I would put them on a flash drive or download them and then have them printed up. The copyrights are long expired, with the exception of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And that copyright belongs to the Manning family, and years ago I got permission to reprint the book. So please do use those books. Don't try to read them online. That book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is not only a key to understanding these broadcasts, as I hope this broadcast will help to illustrate, it's critical in understanding the events that are overtaking this country and this world at this time. I'm going to begin by referencing an article that was sent to me by a listener. Now, this is from a magazine, an online magazine, which is Christian fundamentalist in its orientation. It has a different sort of Christian fundamentalist orientation, though. Some of their references draw on what they call biblical prophecy. I want to make it clear, in case people are not aware of it, that I am not a fundamentalist Christian, and I place no stock in biblical prophecy or in any other sort of religious prophecy. So I'm omitting where they talk about biblical prophecy here. However, this particular article from thetrumpet.com is not only well-written, but has what is, in my opinion, some very good analysis. And I think because of the good writing, I think that reading this article will be effective in helping to communicate the points that I want to communicate here. And so for that purpose, I'm going to go ahead and read this article. But please do observe the caveat. This is a Christian publication, and it does sort of in apposition, it references biblical prophecy. It's also quite scholarly, and I think the biblical prophecy element is for those who are, shall we say, at the more elemental rungs of the Christian ladder, to coin a term. But please observe the caveat about the biblical prophecy here. That notwithstanding, I think the article is well-written and valuable. In particular, I think the emphasis here will lend itself well to an oral presentation. So here goes, to begin with. This is an article from The Trumpet, and from their online edition, thetrumpet.com. This is called Germany Anticipated This Financial Crisis 60 Years Ago. It's by a fellow named Brad McDonald, who is one of their columnists, and it's dated March 19th, 2009. And the subtitle is, Some Germans Are Not in the Least Bit Surprised by the Global Economic Collapse. Here's Why. And the article goes on to say, The Trumpet keeps a keen eye on Germany. For nearly two decades, the Trumpet staff has waited, watched, and written about the emergence of a globally dominant, German-led bloc of European states. We have warned specifically that a spectacular global financial crisis centered in the United States will likely bring this event to fruition. We are not entirely alone in this expectation. The following is a snippet from a secret memorandum written by high-ranking German officers and distributed among an elite group of German leaders in Bonn and other parts of the world. It is an electrifying picture of current events. Now, before I go ahead and read this excerpt, let me note that this is an excerpt from a Madrid circular letter that was put together by the Nazi government in exile that effectively ran not only Germany through a secret network of control called a Führungsring. We talk about this in AFA number 37 at great length. It's dealt with at great length by T.H. Tettens in his aforementioned book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, from 1961. This is not only put together by for circulation among an elite group of German leaders in Bonn, but for what I call the Underground Reich, a Third Reich that went underground and underwent a global diaspora. Probably the best-known place is Latin America, but it went to a lot of other places, the Middle East, Australia, and eventually and primarily the United States. That Underground Reich has effectively run Germany, and the Bormann Economic Network, about which I spoke earlier and which is the focal point of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, controls not only the German economy and the German core corporations, but it is what one banker referred to as the greatest concentration of economic power under a single control in all of world history. And its behavior through the German core corporations and the German commercial banks is front and center in the analysis presented here. But this secret memorandum is that Madrid circular letter from 1950, and it's not made entirely clear here by the author exactly what it is. This circular letter was put together by the Underground Reich, specifically for consumption of its various members around the world and for its elite group of German leaders in Bonn, which was controlled by the Underground Reich. This, again, was written in 1950, and that Madrid circular letter is reprinted in its entirety in an appendix to Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens from 1953. Here's the excerpt, and again, this is in 1950. Economic difficulties will one day plunge the United States down from its present dizzy heights. Such a catastrophe can be brought about through crafty manipulations and through artificially engendered crises. Such maneuvers are routine measures which have already been employed in international power struggle and will be used again and again as long as economic rivals fight for power positions and markets in the world. It is quite conceivable that America, weakened by a depression, will one day seek support from a resurrected Germany. Such a prospect would open tremendous possibilities for the future power position of a bloc introducing a new order in the world. And as we're going to see in side two of this program, that new order basically is the European Monetary Union, which is the realization of the plans put together by pan-German theoretician Friedrich Liest in the mid-19th century. Liest envisioned a central European German-dominated economic union as a vehicle for effecting world domination by Germany and unseating what was then Great Britain as the dominant power on Earth. Of course, today, or at least for the time being and up until recently, the dominant power on Earth was another Anglo-Saxon power, the United States of America. But it is going down. We're going to talk about that, the European Monetary Union as a realization of Liest's theories inside. We've spoken about that before, and we spoke about it in conjunction with the formation of the Euro and the European Monetary Union back in the latter part of the last century, in the late 1990s. The last paragraph of this memorandum, again, It is quite conceivable that America, weakened by a depression, will one day seek support from a resurrected Germany. Such a prospect would open tremendous possibilities for the future power position of a bloc introducing a new order in the world. And Brad McDonald goes on to comment, that was written in 1950. It can be found in T.H. Tetten's 1953 book, Germany Plots with the Kremlin. Its prescience is chilling. Survey the current global financial crisis and the changes it is precipitating. Economic, and he goes on to quote the various parts of this memorandum and then editorialize on them. Economic difficulties have plunged the United States down from its dizzy heights. Check. Such a catastrophe could be brought about, or was brought about, through crafty manipulations and through artificially engendered crises. Check. America, weakened by a depression, is seeking support from a resurrected Germany. Check. Such a prospect is opening tremendous possibilities for the future power position of a bloc introducing a new order in the world. Check. And by the way, recently Barack Obama sought the support of Germany and the European powers in attempting to pull the world out of the depression. Specifically, he wanted a larger stimulus package or more proactive measures to be accomplished by Germany and Europe. Perhaps time permitting, we'll talk a little more about that inside too. Continuing, however, with the analysis presented here by The Trumpet, again a Christian publication, I think their analysis is accurate and it's well written, and I think it again is useful for the oral presentation of this. I do not place any stock in biblical prophecy or their use of same. So with that caveat, let's continue. Brad McDonald, from the article Germany Anticipated This Financial Crisis 60 Years Ago, goes on to comment, with its economic landscape strewn with surging unemployment lines, writhing stocks, and rotting corpses of banks, financial institutions, and businesses, it's hard to deny, quote, economic difficulties, unquote, have brought America down from its dizzying heights. Similarly, piles of evidence, think Bernie Madoff, Lehman Brothers, and liberal bank lending standards, testify to crafty manipulation, unquote, as a root cause of the crisis. What about the notion that artificially engendered crises precipitated by foreign forces are also partly to blame for the collapse of the American financial system? British author and historian Sarah Moore recently delved into this historically significant, eerily familiar trend. Armed with facts and historical precedent, Moore details in the European Journal how Germany, employing a similar formula to what it used in the 1930s, is craftily manipulating EU economic policy in an effort to undermine the U.S. One fundamental cause of the credit crisis in America, Moore suggests, was Germany's exploitation of the euro. And we're going to read this article from the European Journal from May of 2008. Now, again, in a couple of programs which will be annotated in the written description for this broadcast, those done as the euro and the European Monetary Union were coming into being, I noted that this was the realization of the plans that were formulated by Friedrich List, and I also noted America's politics of debt and the fact that America had been able to maintain its relative position of hegemony in the world by borrowing against the dollar's status as reserve currency. It was the reserve currency of choice. Now, however, a great many countries are wondering about that, and China, for one, has publicly voiced anxiety about the soundness of the dollar. And my guess is, and I'm certainly not alone in this regard, that one of the things that will come out of this crisis is the weakening of the dollar as reserve currency of choice, or perhaps its fundamental replacement with the euro, and that will fundamentally alter America's position in the world. In fact, it's already been pretty fundamentally altered already. The Bush administration didn't leave much untouched in that respect. We're going to go into this article later, however. Returning once again to Brad McDonald's Trumpet article, armed with facts and historical precedent, more details in the European Journal how Germany, employing a similar formula to what it used in the 1930s, is craftily manipulating EU economic policy in an effort to undermine the U.S. One fundamental cause of the credit crisis in America, Moore suggests, was Germany's exploitation of the euro. This interesting argument deserves close scrutiny. When the euro first came online in January of 1999, the European Central Bank, headquartered in Frankfurt, patterned after Germany's Bundesbank and heavily influenced by Germans, ensured interest rates remained at around 2%. This was done in part to help stabilize and promote the growth of the German economy. By maintaining low interest rates, Moore says, the German-led ECB caused global investors to flock to higher-yielding U.S. treasuries, distorting money markets and facilitating easy credit in America. The ECB's policy, Moore says, helped prime American credit markets for rupture. This became inevitable after December of 2005 when the ECB, having maintained low interest rates for years, raised interest rates 7 times in a row. In late 2007, with Europe offering higher, increasingly attractive interest rates, cash was flowing briskly into Europe and less briskly from America. Together with the housing crisis, the ECB's calculated diversion of money away from America and into Europe was at least partly responsible for the American credit crisis. According to Moore, it was when the ECB raised its interest rates for the 8th consecutive time in July of 2008 that, quote, stock markets around the world collapsed, unquote. The idea that Germany precipitated the current global economic crisis is intriguing. It's an argument that grows stronger if you factor in the documented proof showing German leaders' plan 60 years ago that, quote, an artificially German, it said in brackets, German-engendered crisis, unquote, would one day bring the U.S. economy down and send America scrambling to Germany for assistance. Barely a day passes without a chorus of American voices, journalists, economists, business leaders, politicians, and even the American president requesting Europe, particularly Germany, to do more to rescue Europe and the rest of the world from the economic chaos. The latest brouhaha between America and Europe, for example, was sparked by President Barack Obama's most recent request that Europe, and especially Germany, lighten the burden of the global economic crisis by enacting the largest stimulus packages for flailing European economies. Lamenting in the New York Times on Monday, that was in March, a prominent economist, Paul Krugman, said he feels Europe is not doing near enough to combat the global economic downturn. It is not uncommon to hear world leaders talking about the need for a new world order, one many agree that needs to be centered in Europe. America's plea to Europe and Germany in particular is desperate and definitive. The world needs you to do more to rescue it from economic calamity. As this predicament intensifies, it will continue to create tremendous possibilities, unquote, for Germany. Watch Germany intently. We don't know if the men who wrote the secret memorandum in 1950 are still alive today. That is in and of itself inconsequential. The more important question is their strategy for a German New World Order still being pursued? It is becoming harder to deny that it is. There will be some who will look at the global economic meltdown and the fact that it is causing both Europe and America to rely more on Germany, admit that this aligns perfectly with the documented Germanic designs, and consider it an unusual coincidence. But doesn't Germany's age-old penchant for global dominion, its provocative role in the two largest wars in history, the fact that it is documented that after World War II, Nazis planned to do it again, the current explosive and uncertain world conditions and the nightmare scenario of another Holocaust make this a subject worthy of deep investigation? By the way, the reference to another Holocaust here is the possibility of nuclear war in the Middle East. Brad McDonald does not there, of course, talk either about Friedrich List and his program for German world domination, executed, basically formulated in the mid-19th century. The European Monetary Union and its euro currency are the realizations of that. The Bormann Economic Network, the Bormann Capital Network, is one of the principal vehicles that certainly sits astride Germany and much of the world economy and the European Monetary Union. We'll talk more about that and more about the decades, even centuries-long program that the Germans, I don't agree with their philosophy, but one cannot but admire the precision and determination of the execution of their strategy. We'll talk about that more inside, too. We're going to turn now to a reading of the European Journal article by Sarah Moore that was alluded to in that story. This is from the European Journal from May of 2008. It's by Sarah Moore, who is described as the author of two books, Peace Without Victory for the Allies, 1918 to 1932, and How Hitler Came to Power. And this article is called Germany, an Emerging Superpower, Comparisons with the 1930s, and it reads, Having previously written two major books, Peace Without Victory for the Allies, 1918 through 32, and How Hitler Came to Power, Sarah Moore offers some valuable insights into Germany as an emerging superpower through drawing comparisons with German power in the 1930s. Now, what Sarah Moore does here is to compare German economic policy in the late 1920s with German economic policy today. Now, according to Moore, we should perhaps remember that one of the primary dynamics of the global economy in the 1920s were the Dawes and Young Plan and the reparations loans that were made to Germany, or the loans that were made to Germany so that it could repay its reparations payments under the Treaty of Versailles. What German Chancellor Brüning did was to structure the German economy in such a way as to hoard the cash that had been channeled to it, largely as a result of the Webb-Pomeroy Act, a loophole in the Antitrust Act of 1913. That act made monopolies illegal, but what the Webb-Pomeroy Act did was to make it legal for cartels to exist. Cartels are international monopolies. And what the robber barons in this country did, they were astride the U.S. economy and in order, and this is a familiar refrain, to escape constricting regulation and its resulting negative implications for profit-making. The enormous capital profits that were derived from the American economic boom of the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, were not reinvested into the American economy. Instead, they were invested abroad, primarily in Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent, Italy. Those countries invested that money largely in strategic heavy industry, used the resulting munitions and armaments to conquer Europe and Asia, respectively. They then basically looted all of the liquid capital of those continents, stored it, and even though Japan and Germany were defeated on the battlefield, they won economically and ultimately politically because they had successfully looted Europe, and when the Carnell and Asia and when the cartel arrangement was put back in power at the conclusion of World War II, and basically the same interests were put back in power in Europe and in Japan, in order to fight the Cold War, they wound up the economic and consequently political winners of World War II. What Sarah Moore talks about is the fact that Chancellor Brüning of Germany increased taxes, held down wages, and turned Germany into the world's largest exporter, which was sitting on mountains of cash. But because unemployment was very high and the average lot of the German worker was desperate indeed, many people were fooled into believing that Germany was actually a very deprived country. And one of the factors contributing to the stock market collapse of 1929 was the fear that Germany would not be able to repay the reparations payments and the resulting panic that had induced in the market. There were many other factors as well, Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and chiefly the fact that the only way capitalism can work is if you invest capital in such a way as to generate more capital, and the enormous profits from the American industrial boom of the Roaring Twenties was invested abroad and not in the American economy. And then at the end of World War II, we recapitalized Germany again under the Marshall Plan. And the enormous capital of the Bormann Organization was then eventually channeled back into Germany in the mid-1950s, and it was that rechanneling of basically the loot from World War II, plus all of the capital Germany held to begin with, that was responsible for the, quote, economic miracle, unquote, of Germany. It is Sarah Moore's position that what Germany is doing now is very similar to what they were doing in the late 1920s, and it is her opinion that fiscal policy convinced many that Germany was poor and would not be repaying its reparations payments, and that was one of the things that panicked the markets. By the way, in the early 1990s, I remember seeing ads in the Wall Street Journal for the repayment of loans that had been made, basically bond issues that had been made under the Dawes and Young plans. Those were still being paid back in the 1990s. Here, however, for purposes of consumption and comparison, is Sarah Moore's article, Germany, an Emerging Superpower, Comparisons with the 1930s. She compares German economic policy in the run-up to the Great Depression and World War II in the late 20s with German economic policy today. She writes, a reassessment of how Germany's deflationary policies contributed to the Great Depression in the 1930s and to her rise to power is long overdue. When in 1930 Heinrich Brüning became Chancellor of Germany, he told his friends in the unions that his chief aim was to liberate Germany from paying war reparations and foreign debt. He felt that if he diverted all Germany's efforts into exports, it would weaken the ability of America and the Allies to force Germany to pay her IOUs if she chose not to. The German unions therefore agreed to Brüning reducing wages, raising taxes, and diverting all industrial activity into exports so as to bring pressure on the Western powers, not realizing to what extent this would mean misery, unemployment, and a diminution of power for the workers. By the way, excuse me, let me change the time frame here. Brüning came to power in 1930, but there was already worry in the late 20s that Germany would not be able to repay its loans, and there was some interesting maneuvering in 1929 with Germany basically making a play on the gold market. Now, a lot of the countries are no longer on the gold standard, but we'll continue here with Sarah Moore's analysis. Brüning's initiative was successful. Millions of people abroad were fooled into believing that Germany herself was really poor and not just her hapless citizens, even though Germany was the greatest exporter in the world with a mountain of cash in the bank. 70 years after the Treaty of Versailles, consensus has at last been reached that the legend of the vindictive treaty was a fable. Yet historians have hesitated to draw new conclusions about the Great Depression, namely, if German politicians escaped censure for their actions in the 20th century, will they be tempted to use deflation for political purposes in the 21st century? It is true that modern Germany is a very different nation from the 1930s. She is a model of democracy and a pillar of the international community. Yet, this must not stop us from voicing our alarm if we see parallels with the Great Depression. The world economy is huge compared with the 1930s, but if Germany imposes a deflationary policy on Europe, it can have an effect worldwide because the European Union comprises nearly 500 people with money to save or spend. The European Central Bank is located in Frankfurt and modeled on the German Bundesbank. When the euro was first introduced, interest rates were kept at 2%, causing a slump in the value of a euro and a mass exodus of surplus funds. However, since 2005, European interest rates have risen 8 times, causing the euro to rise over 50% against the dollar by 2007, both because of the dollar's weakness and to the rise in Europe's interest rates. Foreigners' faith in the euro rests primarily with Germany. Other Euroland countries' economies are not so strong. Indeed, Germany's European neighbors have suddenly discovered that Germany effectively imposed a wage freeze, unquote, on its workers after the adoption of the euro in 1999, clawing back 40% in labor competitiveness against Italy, 30% against Spain, and 20% against France by 2007. Britain's bankers shed few tears over France and Italy when they complained of the ECB interest rate rises making their businesses uncompetitive, or even Spain hit by an ECB-created property bubble. Britain's pound was strong in the spring of 2007. It had moved tightly with the euro, unquote, for the last 3 years, but as it had always paid a little more in interest than the euro, many European countries held their balances in pounds. However, in July of 2007, the Bank of England decided, in view of Britain's rising inflation, that it would raise British interest rates too, 1 month after the ECB. Unfortunately, the combination of the American subprime crisis, an overleveraged home market, and the final European interest rate rise was too much to bear. The mortgage lender Northern Rock cracked, and Britain itself suddenly seemed fragile, too. We'll continue with this analysis and others on Side 2 of this program. However, this concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 671, Update on the Meltdown, Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Financial Crisis. This has been recorded on April 26th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.